I've always made people dance when I play. I mean, I can make people get up and dance. And to me, that's always a real important part of what I do.
Oh, big old jet and a lino, 'cause it's here that I got to stay. Jungle love is driving me mad, it's making me crazy.
Well, you know, we're living in a world that's moving very quickly. We're living in a world where people are assuming less accountability for their actions every day. Very few people really want to enter politics. And so it's really important that it's more important that you deal in your own community, where you live, where it matters to the kids in your neighborhood or to the people in your community. Hey there, this is Steve Miller in the studio for Book of Dreams.
There was never anything flashy about Steve Miller. Most of his fans didn't even know what he looked like. But in the mid-1970s, there wasn't a rock star in the world enjoying any more success than the man they once called the Space Cowboy. Book of Dreams, released in May 1977, came out at the peak of Steve Miller's popularity, barely a year after his first platinum album, Fly Like an Eagle. Book of Dreams soon went platinum too, as did Steve's next release, a greatest hits album in 1978. The Rolling Stone Music Guide says that Fly Like an Eagle and Book of Dreams, which were recorded virtually at the same time, are, and I quote, perfectly constructed albums, end quote. It was an incredible run of hits, and it all started in 1973 with the release of the album The Joker and its song, whose success was so overwhelming that for a while it sent Steve Miller into a sort of semi-retirement. To understand the artistic confidence and creative control that encouraged Steve Miller to make two multi-million sellers back-to-back, we need to discuss the vital importance of that 1973 hit, The Joker, with Steve Miller in the studio.
I'd been working with Glenn Johns, and it seemed like all the time that I was working on my records, I was always arguing with the engineer or arguing with somebody about how I wanted it to be. When I made The Joker, I just went down and did it by myself. It was the first time I had really walked into a studio and called all the shots and was in complete charge. And, you know, getting a number one record kind of made me feel like, well, see? And so from that time on, I never really looked back. Then I just, as soon as we got back from, oh, I think we had about a 60-city tour on The Joker, and we came back, and everybody was completely fried. We were just exhausted. We had been basically touring nonstop for 11 years or something like that, and the band fell apart. We went into the studio, and naturally Capitol's going, we want a new one, we want another one immediately, and, you know, went into the studio for a few days, and I just called him up and said, you know what? We can't record anything. We've made so many albums so quickly that it's just going to take me some time. And, the band is really, you know, fallen apart. We're burned out. So, I'll be in touch when I'm ready. And then I called up my agent and told him not to book any gigs for a year, which of course blew his mind. You know, once you have a little success, then there's a lot of pressure on you to capitalize on that. And what I did was I shut everything down, went to my house and got a tape recorder, a multi-track, 8-track tape recorder set up in my living room and started first resting, then thinking, then writing. And then a year later, I went into the studio and called up Gary Malibur and Lonnie Turner, and we went in and cut about 20, 25 tracks in 11 days. And I took them home and started working on them at home. And about 18 months later, I'd finished Fly Like an Eagle and Book of Dreams.
Thank you. all my friends at home. Goodbye to people I've trusted. I've got to go out and make my way. I might get rich, you know, I might get busted, but my heart keeps calling me backwards as I get on the 707.
Jet Airliner was a song that was written by a blind man named Paul Pina, who had had a real bad time with Albert Grossman, Bob Dylan's manager, and Janis Joplin's manager. And it was a song he had written that was really full of bitter experiences about working with him and having to go back to the East Coast and things like that. And the song was, Paul was so talented. And I mean, he had these amazing, amazing tunes. I took the song and I asked him if I could reorganize it, you know, change it around, lighten it up a little bit and use it. And he said, yeah. It turned out to be a big hit. I mean, we played that song for years now.
The next step for Steve Miller was to take those collected living room tapes to a proper studio.
I went to L.A. and to mix the album. And so I was driving because I had a lot of equipment that I wanted to take and instruments that I wanted to have with me for those last few little things that always happen. And I bought a bunch of albums to listen to on the way down just to check the mixes and stuff. Bought some popular things, some of this, some of that. And I was really surprised at how bad all the albums were, because they would have like one or two great songs and then like eight just throwaway songs, you know. And the record industry had gone back to that same thing. They're there right now, you know, where you have one hit song and then you just fill a bunch of stuff in with the old drum machine or whatever. And I realized that I had enough material for two albums when I went down to mix, and I was going to take the best of these two albums and make one album. Fly Like an Eagle came out, and I thought I really had it. You know, when I finished that album, I knew that's what people wanted to hear. I went and told my record company that I was going to sell 4.5 million copies of it. I mean, I didn't say it in an arrogant way. I just said, this record is going to sell 4.5 million copies. It's going to be the biggest thing I ever did. Here it comes. And as soon as it went out to radio, it was so astonishing because, you know, FM radio had just finally become established and was really beginning to open up and get a big audience and really compete with AM radio. This was 75, 76. They were really beginning to get their own, you know, who cares what the top 40 is? This is ours, you know. And they would play that whole album, both sides, without interruption, for weeks. Just took care of it, you know. It was what they wanted to sound like. It was what they wanted. It was what I wanted. It was the right, everything together at the right time.
There is some real ear candy on the Book of Dreams album, such as the groove on the song Swingtown.
Well, Swingtown was a pure pleasure to work on. It was just a production tune. You know, I mean, from the minute I heard it, it was a production in my head. And the guitar solo reminds me a lot of Les Paul's work. I did it a lot the way Les would do his stuff. And we also had a Condor Innovator playing rhythm guitar. That was the first synthesizer guitar. And by that time, they were old relics. We had to find two of them in a junk pile and pull them apart and put them together to make one of them work. And it did all those big chords and stuff. And that song was just, you know, just a complete production hook from the beginning to the end. I've always made people dance when I play. I mean, I can make people get up and dance. And to me, that's always a real important part of what I do. I always like people to come to my concert and have a real joyous occasion and to dance. I mean, that's to me the best thing that can happen. I mean, if everything's working right and if the sound is right, they don't have a chance. They're going to get up and dance, you know, and that's part of the fun, you know, is to, like, take a bunch of strangers, people you don't know, all have a straight look on their face, and then all of a sudden create this harmony between everybody. It's a real important part of what playing concerts is about.
And while liberally using synthesizers and sound effects on Book of Dreams, nevertheless, there are pastoral soundscapes painted by acoustic guitar, piano, and harmonica, too, on such songs as Wintertime.
Yeah, that was a tune that just kind of had a kind of a haunting melody. I was working on Babes in the Wood and Wintertime. They were these kind of acoustic kind of Robin Hood kind of sounding, Boys in the Forest kind of songs, you know, and I really, you know, it was just a song that I was working on that I liked, a real mood piece. Reminded me of the autumn, birds migrating and things like that. A lot of these songs seemed like dreams. You know, some of them, I mean, I'd be working on them late at night. You know, it just came to me one morning. I remember I was sleeping. I woke up and this piano part was in my head, so I just went right into my studio and I sat down and I started playing. And Book of Dreams just really came to me.
In the winter time, when all the leaves are brown and the wind blows, so chill, and the birds have all flown for the summer. I'm calling, hear me calling, hear me
from Steve Miller's Book of Dreams captures those long shadows and short days in that melancholy season. Next, find out why Steve Miller purposely left his face off of his multi-million selling album covers. Follow In the Studio on Facebook and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio with Steve Miller on the anniversary of his musical Book of Dreams.
Hey there, this is Steve Miller in the studio for Book of Dreams.
I'm Redbeard, and you can try this experiment. Grab any of Steve Miller's hit albums, from The Joker to Fly Like an Eagle to Book of Dreams, and try to find a photo of his face on the cover. When Steve Miller had the number one album in the U.S., he could still mow the lawn in anonymity, which was no fluke, according to Steve Miller.
When I did the artwork and did the things on the covers and stuff, I was really just trying to keep things into a mood and not really promote myself as, you know, as a celebrity. I always felt like what I was doing was musical. And I started watching what was going on around me. I remember going to a Cat Stevens concert one time. And I had the number one record in the country. I was sitting in about row 15. And I was sitting there watching Cat Stevens, and Boz came in, and he was sitting about three rows in front of me. And Boz had a very public career in San Francisco. He was always in the society pages. He was always in everything, you know. And man, the guy couldn't watch the concert. I mean, people did not leave him alone. They were just after him all the time. So I began to see that happening to people. I realized that, like my mom said, fools' names and fools' faces are always seen in public places, you know. And I just started taking my image out of the equation and making it more artwork, more of a mood in the band than really like five crazy guys who want to, you know, entertain you, or one crazy guy who wants to. And I've kept to that pretty well.
But lest you confuse discretion with apathy, Steve Miller certainly does not advocate an uninformed or uninvolved citizenry.
Well, you know, we're living in a world that's moving very quickly. We're living in a world where people are assuming less accountability for their actions every day. Very few people really want to enter politics. Very few people want to be a county commissioner or be on the board of education or have time to even give the kind of service that a community needs. You're finding, we're beginning to find in our communities that there are even elected offices that go unfilled because no one is even willing to run for some of the offices. And so it's really important that it's more important that you deal in your own community, where you live, where it matters to the kids in your neighborhood or to the people in your community. If you're in a position like I am where it's fairly easy for me to, you know, put a concert together. I mean, it's a lot of work, but I can raise $100,000 pretty quickly if I want to, you know, do something in my community. And we do, you know, that's what we try and do. And we try and help people that are really, it's not about politics or left or right. It's more about the community itself and the issues that are important. And a lot of important issues get swept under the rug, nuclear waste being one of them. It's probably one of the worst problems we have in our society and in the future. I mean, we're leaving a legacy of poison that's going to do nothing but get worse. It's not going to get better. You know, here's a group of people that know that. When you go and talk to a senator about it, their eyes glaze over. It's not a sexy, you know, voters issue. They don't really want to deal with it, and they tap dance all around it and say nothing, do nothing. And you know, nuclear power has never dealt with their waste issue, and they've created huge deposits of poisons all over the United States and all over the world that have serious health effects that are going to affect our groundwater. You know, it's not an easy issue to deal with, but here are some people that are working very hard and continuously at it, and I can help, so that's what I do.
With a prolific period of woodshedding, 25 or 30 songs, now it was time for Steve Miller to cull certain songs into groups that would flow together into a balanced, complete single album.
Some of them got mixed and rejected. Some of them were deliberately held off the first album. As the first album started coming together, then I began to realize that not only was I working on one album, but I was working on another one. So it was during the mixing process when I realized what I had. What it is like I'll build on something and build a bass, like a rhythm track or something. And then the spontaneous things will be the solos or the singing. I may start singing it, and then I may go back and change the rhythm track because I've learned something from the singing of it, or it's developed this way and that way. And I'll develop something all the way out to its simplest, most thought-out form. And then the actual singing of the song should be a very casual and quick and light thing, so it feels that way. The album was finished. We were wrapping it up. Lonnie Turner showed up, and he had a tape, a little round 3-inch plastic reel with him. And he said, "Steve, you know, here's a song you ought to hear." And I said, "Lonnie, you know, this is the last day of mixing. You know, I've been here," and this one took 12 days to mix. And everything became much more difficult because of the success of Fly Like an Eagle. The engineers wanted to take more time. Everything was a much bigger deal. And it was driving me nuts because I just wanted to go in and do it all. And so I was getting pretty irritated with everybody not being on time and just doing what we needed to do, you know. So here comes Lonnie in the last day with his tape, like I said, and I was kind of, okay, well, let's put it on. And we had to screw around and find a quarter-inch machine someplace and put it up. And it was Greg Douglas playing Jungle Love in the garage with LT and some guy you never heard of singing it, you know. And I just said, "Who's playing guitar in this?" He said, "Well, it's this guy named Greg Douglas." And I said, "Is he around? I mean, do you think you could get a hold of Greg?" And he said, "Yeah." I said, "Do you think you could get him over in the studio this afternoon?" He said, "I don't know. I'll call." So he made a phone call. Greg came over, and we cut Jungle Love in 45 minutes.
I'm
Byron is a great keyboard player and a great sound effects man, and I get him usually after we would cut tunes. I'll get Byron in the studio and have him do things, you know, over tracks and stuff. And this song was, you know, had such an attitude. It just sounded like it needed that big whistle, you know. That was Byron's deal. All the shows we did, we had to have a special mic for Byron to do his whistle. Yeah, a whistle mic. That's right.
Still to come, Steve Miller shares the spotlight with another talented guitar player and explains why you should think globally but act locally. And Steve looks back over the years since Book of Dreams. Follow In the Studio on Facebook and check out inthestudio.net for a whole lot more. I'm Redbeard in the studio with Steve Miller on the anniversary of Book of Dreams.
Hey there, this is Steve Miller in the studio for Book of Dreams. We had been on the road with Boz and with James Cotton, and we were doing a bunch of jamming in the studio, and Sacrifice was a tune that Curly Cook, who had been playing in my band, and Les Dudak, who had been playing in Boz's band, had put together. It was just a great tune. I mean, as soon as I heard it, I wanted to do it, and I wanted to do it on my album. And so I took these guys into the studio up in Seattle. We had just ended a tour, just finished this tour. And we went into the studio for a few days and we cut this. And that's Les Dudak playing solo on it. And boy, is it a burner. I mean, he's a great guitar player.
Thought about the folks back home, all those miles that we had roamed. Still can see your pretty hair. When I come back, will you be there? Like a kite, I hope you find your life. I pray they treat you right. What a sacrifice. Miles and miles sweet home. Thought I had the love with you, but I found out that you weren't true. You made me feel so nice, ready for wedding rites. Then you said no dice. What a sacrifice. Thank you.
and Sacrifice on Steve Miller's Book of Dreams, featuring lead guitar from Les Dudek. After leaving Texas, Steve Miller lived in some of the most beautiful places in the continental United States, including the San Francisco Bay Area, then Seattle, then the Rocky Mountains of Sun Valley, Idaho. Now, Steve has relocated to New York City, and when it comes to volunteering, Steve walks it like he talks it.
The latest and greatest ones are the Snake River Alliance in Ketchum, Idaho. And the Snake River Alliance is a group of women who for the past 25 years have been keeping track of nuclear waste that's brought into the INEL out on the desert in Idaho. We have 53 nuclear reactors here that the government runs, and they're pretty sloppy with it. And these people have this horrible task of keeping track of everything that comes in, what's going on, and going to all the community meetings. And this is an issue that no one cares about or wants to pay any attention to or really wants to know. And these people for 25 years have been doing all the heavy lifting. And so every year we make a sizable donation to their annual budget, played their 25th anniversary, where we put on a huge community show and brought the Steve Miller Band over, and it was really great. It was a great one. Then another one I do is called NOAA, and NOAA is the Northwest Organization for Animal Help, and they go to all the pounds in Seattle and gather up all the animals that are scheduled to be put down and take them to a new $3 million facility, rehab them and find them homes. They found homes for over 4,000 animals in the last 3 years. We've done a benefit for them every year. I used to do a lot of Earth Day work and did the Lost Cities tour where we did environmental concerts all over the United States. But after doing national events like that, I decided that it's more important to work in your own backyard. You take a look out your window and see what's on your horizon in your community, and you take part and jump in. And then we had the Miller Foundation, which donates, $40,000 or $50,000 a year to all the local, Meals on Wheels and just local groups that do community work, the Boys Club, the Girls Club, the YMCA, the whatever. There's quite a long list of local community services that we help support.
Nobody loves you like the way I do.
Now, I always considered what I was doing, what I was working at, was being a musician who would play for my entire lifetime. Les Paul is my inspiration, and I always felt like I'm not a celebrity, I'm not a pop star, I'm a musician, and I want to play music my entire life. So that was always, and from the beginning, that's always been my goal. Now, the fact that it's turned out to be years of people listening to these albums and being willing to come out and see us play, that's beyond anybody's wildest dreams. I mean, you would never say, I've got a plan for the next 35 years, you know. But, you know, we just played, had a great show, and it was like standing in front of a jet engine. Those kids were so excited, and they had so much fun, and the band had so much fun that we're very blessed. And I love touring. I love playing for my audience, and we can't wait to hit that stage and play. And that audience has given us that enthusiasm, and the fact that they're still buying tickets, they still want to see us play, that they listen to the new pieces that we do, that they love the old songs. It's a great thing. And in my wildest dreams, I would have never guessed it would have lasted this long.
I'm Redbeard. We'll be back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guest, Steve Miller. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2017, all rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brunet. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, @RedbeardRocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net.